Okay, welcome. This is our second class of the. This is our second class. Last week we had a scholar in residence. We had Rabbi Steve Brzezinski, who was got more feedback. It was fantastic. Good. You guys happy?
Yeah.
All right. Well, people come in. FYI, November the 7th, we have Rabbi Menachem Yitzchak coming from Israel. That's right. And he asked. He says, Rabbi, ask the class. What topic would you like me to talk about? So send me an email if you have some ideas. Obviously, his strength is Tanakh. So, you know that was, you can, so shoot me an email. I'll get some feedback from you guys, and he's coming in November 7th, so make sure you're present. Okay, so one of the suggestions was to sort of give a sense of the totality of the curriculum. So I made this little nifty little infographic. Not so nifty, whatever. What we're doing is there are 10 steps to redemption. And what we're doing here is that the journey of the Jewish people in Egypt is not just that point, but it's a universal journey of all Jews. And ironically, it's no different than the journey of a Baal Tshuva, because the Jews are starting from absolute assimilation. The Medrash says they just have a few cultural elements. They have some Jewish dress, some Hebrew, a Jewish name. That's it. They don't have that much. So it's a Jew that we are very familiar with, a Jew who has just a little teeny bit of cultural connection. And we're going to start from that. But you see, there is the exile process, which has three steps. Now, each step might have a multiple class, by the way. Then there's a tshuva. There's an awakening. And there's a reprioritization, there's a change, and then there's a redemption, okay? So that's the totality. So we're going to, all the class are going to fit into this rubric, okay? Is that clear? Okay, so it's 10 steps. So we're going to deal with tonight the first step, which is the exile, strangers in a strange land. Okay, now, of course, we have to start with a video.
I didn't see this movie.
Well, the scene looked... You know, there's an additional benefit of the senior fellowship. I'm gonna introduce the movie.
Did you see the movie first?
I did not. I just saw that.
It's all a clip.
Yeah, I don't have time for it. I got no time. Okay. Hold on a second. Let me just make sure I share. Shmuel, can you see the screen? The movie.
Hi.
I'll take those. Also need the second batch, the second class. Oh, thank you so much.
Okay.
Okay, good? All right, so here we go. Anna, the Vakasha, the lights. Could go the full experience.
Welcome to the United States of America. Next. Your name, please.
Eva Subushka. She's my sister. Is something wrong?
She has to be deported.
No! We'll never go back. Yes. Can you help me? Please.
You're a very lucky lady. Do you have a place to stay?
Do you know somewhere?
Yeah, I know a place. I can get her off the island. Whether she's cured or not. You know people. It'd be difficult and costly, but it can be done.
I need to work.
I can take it to my place of business.
Don't give up the hope. The American dream is waiting for you.
This
and I'm mad at what you do. You got a right to be happy, Eva.
All right. All right. Anyways, just it was a little bit too artsy, cryptic, so I'm going to read the little bio. Actually, somebody else read. Who'd like to read the little description? Matt?
Yes. And James Gray, the immigrant. And James Gray's the immigrant.
Eva.
Eva Sapolsky and her sister sailed to New York from their native Poland in search for a new start in the American dream. When they reach Ellis Island, doctors discovered that Magda is ill, and the two women are separated. Eva is released onto the main street of Manhattan, while her sister is quarantined. Along with nowhere to turn, desperate to reunite with Magda, Eva quickly falls prey to Bruno, a charming but wicked man who takes her in and forces her into prostitution. The rival of Orlando, a dashing stage magician who is also Bruno's cousin, restores her self-belief and hopes for a brighter future, becoming her only chance to escape the nightmare in which she finds herself.
Okay. All right, we're not going to go. All right, so, all right, question number one. What crisis did the sisters face? In what ways is crisis characteristic of the vulnerability of immigrants? How appropriately timely as we have a march toward the American border? Okay, what's the crisis they face?
Either she goes to Ellis Island with her sister, or she goes to New York.
She got out. You saw that she was free because she did not have.
But she could have stayed with her sister, right, and gone back.
Okay, she could have gone back to Poland, but which was why they leave. Why do you guess they left Poland around the turn of the century?
It was famine.
It was a horrible experience. Millions of people left mainland Europe because it was just a horrible experience.
And going back would be
negative. Right. So, I don't know about death, but it was definitely super negative. Now, and the problem is that her sister has a disease. They would not let her in. Okay. So what's the crisis?
Go to New York or go back with her sister?
More than that. Is that and more. What else? What's the crisis? Well,
the first crisis is family separation, and then.
Okay, so you can get in, but you're gonna go. You're gonna never see your sister again. Hey, what else?
And then once in, the second crisis is not having money.
Right. So therefore, you don't know having money. What else do they not have? No place to stay. No family,
no
language, and and so who rescued Eva from this crisis? Exactly, Bruno the Pimp. Who, of course, initially looked as very suave, as they always do, right? Right? Oh, yeah. All right. And how did this rescue result in blackmail? I mean, it's not didn't spell it out so clearly in the video clip, but you can figure it out.
Yeah.
In other words, how did you? She said, "I'll rescue." You know, how did there was a, what was a rescue? What was Bruno's offer?
He's going to get her sister off the island.
Right. I will bribe what these people do, but in exchange, work in my business, which was one part dinner theater, because apparently dessert was served.
But he didn't tell her that.
They generally don't. If you go to pimp school, that's not what you're doing. You don't tell people how you're going to take advantage of them. This is how you're going to be involved in be the victim of sexual assault. No, they typically don't ever say that. That's not how it works.
She was completely dependent on
him. Right. She worked. He got her to pay that she was actually dependent upon him. She was dependent upon him, and she took him into his home. I don't know exactly what he took. basically he was providing all her basic needs, and therefore, oh, you want your sister? It's going to cost you. Okay, now. All right, and what does this blackmail reveal about the underlying mentality of the rescuer, Bruno?
He's not really in it to help her, he's in it to help himself.
That's a nice way of saying it. Okay, that's true. What else can you say about the guy?
He preys on the weak.
Yeah.
Exactly. He's the definition of evil. The definition of evil is a person who takes advantage of people's vulnerabilities and weakness so they can personally profit. That's a wicked person. That's the wicked person. That's the most unjust you can be. Take somebody's down, you step on them further, so you can profit even a little bit. Okay, so that's an evil person. That's what we call in Hebrew a Russia, a wicked person. Yes.
If you would have asked her straight up, hey, you might not want this, but it could be a prostitute. You want it. This is the only way, it might be the only way out. You know, which it seemed like it didn't do.
It was more of a seduction situation. Yeah.
So if you kind of asked her straight up, would he still be considered an evil person? Obviously, he's in an evil industry. You know, doing that, but if he's like, hey, on the street, you can try to survive, or I got a kind of shady way for you to survive, but it's an option.
I think it's slightly.
Is evilness the bait and switch
it's slightly better. Slightly.
No deception.
No, take that deception part. But it's a. But basically. Her knowing, preying on the most difficult circumstance is also an evil thing. In other words, what's the attitude of Judaism when you see a person who's weak and poor? What's the mitzvah? What's
giving the Torah?
You help them out. Tzedakah, chesed. No, it's the opposite. it's an opportunity to overcome our natural selfish instinct and to. I mean, that is a quintessential mark of a Jew. What's a mark of a Jew? A person is down and out. You help them out. Not, oh, they're down and out. Let me take advantage of them further. Right? That's like Judaism 101.
Yeah.
All right? We go on. Now we're going to start. This is all preparation to our Jewish people's experience. In what way is this underlying mentality of the rescue characteristic of powerful people in general?
He's using his power to help people?
But what is the underlying mentality? We're looking for a universal principle here.
He wants more power.
Okay, so number one is that powerful people want more power. There's a lust for power, an unsatiable lust for power. And
they almost like deify themselves, like they're like this all powerful. Like I have this, you know, I'm saving these people. Like it's almost a
they have rationalization for it.
Less rationalization for it.
Or they don't think any of the rules are really
to them, right? Probably. Well, how do you think? I mean, without watching the movie or just seeing from the club, how do Bruno or people like Bruno look at Eva? And feel about Eva?
You mean people in general?
They don't like those
types of
people.
Yeah, they don't like
me. Meaning like they don't respect those type of people to be in that type of situation.
Okay. What else do they by definition believe?
That they don't matter.
They're uneducated?
Well, it's not simply that they're uneducated.
Well, they're there to serve their...
That's it. The definition of the wicked person looks at all people as a tool for their satisfaction. So it's not just simply Eva is there. She's actually doing her role. Her role as a subject in his life, since she is weak and she can't take advantage, therefore that's her role, her identity. She's a tool for him. That's what the Rosh Hashanah views. In other words, that's why he has no problem doing it, because that's the state of nature. There are the strikes, the survival of the fittest. They're weak. They deserve to be, enslaved. That's it. It's only Jews that goes to the revolution of the idea of Tzelem Elokim, which is then adopted by the Constitution, that there is a every person has an inalienable right. They come from the created reflecting a certain godliness. Tzelem Elokim. Otherwise, as far as the law of the state of nature, why not? Or why should you do Why, in other words, why not take advantage of them? It's as far as the survival of the fittest. You have the power. They don't, take advantage.
The strong take what they can, and the weak suffer what they must.
Correct. This is also the philosophy of Nietzsche. There's a whole worldview. But this is not just a fancy philosophy. This is basically the philosophy of all tyrants, all wicked people. You have met people like this before. Have you met people like this before? Who don't intrinsically have an intrinsic value of people is what they can manipulate them and use them for. People who use people. You have to, if you're in the world of business, you will meet people like this as a regularity. Because it takes a level of education, a moral education, not to be this way. In other words, what really Bruno is the default setting in animal man. You know, I'm talking about man versus woman, I'm talking about the animal personality, male or female, basically is my job is to eat your lunch. And if you don't stop me, you're screwed. You know? That's it. Right? I mean, you know, you're dealing that with like people who are like dealing with like that. You know, sales people who are ruthless, or, you know, agents who are ruthless, or boss who are ruthless. It's all that you see all the time.
It's a general work environment being that way too.
Well, that's even a horrible situation where you feel like, you know, it's such a cutthroat environment where they will just use you to step on you as another step up on the corporate or company ladder. Who's experienced that situation, that kind of brutal situation? That's half the class.
I guess that's what I was getting at earlier. Like, but you kind of know what you're signing up for. You know, a lot of folks, like, not like, no, meaning if the pimp guy told her, hey, there's an opportunity. You might not like it, but it's an opportunity. Like,
yeah, but if he said that, then she would say no.
But the finish here.
Like, she would agree to something.
People would. Exactly.
Okay, I mean, but no, but the bottom line is, That is denying her humanity.
I agree.
I'm just saying that means that that's the one over. Yeah. It's slightly less, so he takes away. There's the deception plus the injustice. Now you just have the injustice.
Well,
it's better, slightly better.
Yeah, but like your example of a lot of us at work, you know, like, of course, like, we're not in the prostitution industry, but our jobs, you might feel like, oh, like my. You know, our bosses are.
Well, I'm happy to hear that, by the way.
That's part of the interview. Right?
Part of the senior fellowship. Are you involved in prostitution? No. Woo! You can go on now. Even what people refer to is that. You know, what are they HR or you know like human like the phrase like human capital. That's a very dehumanizing. We don't call human. We don't even our part of the idea. We have the practice of not even counting Jews to reflect upon the sort of the infinite value of people. You reduce people like, oh, there's 5 people in the room, 10 people, 20 people in the room. That's relating them as the person, limiting them to just a material object. You now have to do that. I was saying that's why Judaism is so revolutionary in its worldview on people, all people.
But how do they do it when they deal with business?
You doesn't mean that you don't make a presentation to a client. Doesn't mean that you
Yeah, but what about the Jewish owned businesses that are here in New York that are huge and they have human resources department? They clearly gotta count their people. Yeah.
No, I'm saying, okay, so luckily we count shirts. We can do it by, but just the idea is not that we don't know the number. It's just to have an idea that it's not right to count, you know, how many heads. I mean, of course, you count the name.
Yeah, like,
how they count in the thing. You count the names, whatever.
Oh, fine.
It's not about not knowing the number. It's about relating to a person as a number in a very, you know, as the person just an object. Okay, I'm just saying, this is a revolutionary idea.
Like a weird gray area.
What's the gray area? You mean?
Like, you don't want to dehumanize people and the person is an object, but you have this collective larger goal to handle what's happening.
Like,
if you have a business,
Right. Yes, I need 50 workers. Yeah, I need 50 workers.
Yeah, like what do you?
You can say 50 workers.
No, right? I'm not talking about counting people. I mean, it's just when you have such a, like a large company or many different companies, it's just by the nature of business in general, it's going to be dehumanizing because of like
right.
the system.
Yeah. You're right. It's very hard. I mean, let me give you. It requires a tremendous amount of mindfulness. Because let me give you some illustration.
Yeah.
If you go to a small community on Shabbos, you walk into shul, what will the people do? You've been to a small town. Well, what will everybody do?
Welcome you. They'll give you their seat.
Yeah, for sure. Right. Right. They'll say, first of all, they'll say good Shabbos to you. They'll ask you. When I was in Seattle growing up, so that's like a hick town. A new person came, like a big deal. Hey, somebody, where are you from? You're from New York. You're from the big city. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, it was like a big deal, and you in person you make them feel honored because it was each person was like special. You go to New York to a shul in the Upper West Side, this might happen. You might walk into a shul, they may not say good job. You can come in, you can leave, nobody knows. That's why at MG is unique that we specifically try to make it a warm thing to try to counter that by having people who are volunteering to be the official greeter. Because that greeting makes it one person feels like I'm part of a warm community, that makes all the difference. Simple as that. Let's keep on going. All right, there's much to talk about this. Do all people share this issue? And do we, the members of the class, have this issue? When, where, this, are we talking about us, where and when? In other words, it's very easy to talk about those people. How about us?
No.
We do not have the senior fellowship or transcendent beings, and we do not have.
I think everybody here personally.
Now, I agree that nobody here would utilize their power to put somebody into prostitution. I'm very comfortable about vouching for you guys on that red.
I think it's on the spectrum, we all have varying degrees of it inside ourselves and the situation.
Okay, let me make it a little bit. Let me fine tune the question. Let me get a little closer to home here. Has anybody here been a supervisor of employees?
Yes.
Now, you by definition have power over that person, whether that person is going to be remain in employment, get a promotion, and you can take advantage of that situation. Can't you? And that, by the way, you know, and especially oftentimes if you are being pushed, oftentimes in situations like that, when you're being, let's say, felt treated poorly by the person above, it's not an uncommon experience for you to absorb that negativity and aggression and being feel abused to then become the abused becomes the abuser and in turn push the other person down.
You mean like being a supervisor, like you get like these people under you working on a project, and you're really hard on them, you're pushing them hard, and they're putting this project together, but then you tell your boss, like, you take all the credit.
Oh, so that's one aspect, you know, denying their contribution, that's one way. Or B, just utilizing, just taking advantage of them. Oh, by the way, if you're going out for lunch, can you pick me up, you know, or make them into your personal assistant? I like with milk. Right, which is like a little bit dehumanizing. You know, I mean, make them into like into a what's a nice way of saying that? Personal gopher. Gopher.
Yeah,
that's the non-human. Well, yes.
So can I make a connection to this? So we're born into assimilated worlds, and we have the ability to serve Hashem. That's our potential. But instead, the people that raise us kind of, you know, take advantage of us and push us towards this different type of purpose and different types of things that aren't in our best interest.
Sure, we're going to get to that. You're jumping ahead. We're going to get to that. Hold on. I'm talking about not the Jewish issue. I'm talking about what experiences in the where you have been a supervisor have you felt that at least that urge to take advantage of the situation? Give me situations where, or a bit easier, where do you supervise take advantage of their position?
Harvey Weinstein.
Okay, that's ridiculous. Okay, yeah, yes, yes, yes. Yeah, I'm not okay, but that's the extreme. Yeah, come up to the hotel room. Yeah, we're not. That's a little bit. Wait, how about much more subtler and much less grotesque? Yes, Adrian.
I think it happens regularly when you go to a restaurant. Later, the way you treat your waiter, you sort of have.
That's a good example. Yes. Right. Are you, in other words, are you that person who is like, oh, this person has to wait on me? And are you, you know, hard on them unjustly?
A lot of people are.
Right. I have my personal practice on that, since I'm wearing a kippah, and so I'm not just a Jew, but I'm a discernible Jew. A person will always do the, you know, the 15-20% tip. I don't want them to say, I just don't want them to say that. Even if it was substandard service, and you will get substandard service in kosher eateries. That will definitely happen. Okay? So whatever. So it's just not worth, you know, not after an extra couple of bucks. Oh, you know, and I'm going to really teach them. Not to teach them. You know, what's the point? So for the $3-5 extra bucks, you know, walk out there, you know, and then that's it. So that's a good example, by the way. That's an excellent example. I mean, many people have apartments. Does anybody here have hired a cleaning person? Okay. So you can really there's a lot of ways. Oftentimes, that cleaning person maybe, shall we say, doesn't have their green card, perhaps. And you can take advantage of the situation that they're an illegal immigrant.
Somebody take advantage of people who are not as smart as you, like people in
menial jobs? Correct. There's whole, even though you're not, nobody here is a CEO of a major Forbes 500 company.
But you're not.
Yeah.
Advantage of just hiring.
No, that's a myth. No, but I'm saying, but I'm just saying you could do certain things like you could be like, you know, for example, you can, let's say, call, you know, the person was expecting to work on you on a Wednesday, and like 2 minutes before they show up, you cancel on them. Don't come. But meanwhile, they lose the whole day of work. Like, I'm not dealing with a halachic implication, because there are maybe halachic implications about that. You may have to pay them anyways, because they can't get another job. That's FYI. You know, there's certain things that people are acting in a very unjust manner because those people are lower than us. They're doing the garbage work. You know what I'm saying? Right? All right. All right. So we're going to get to that. Now let's get to, this is all, we can go on this all night long. Let's take it back to our study of the Chumash. Yes, you can. The movie what?
Never heard?
No, not seen it.
Is anybody seen it?
I
this movie is not an endorsement, but whatever. It got a couple of Academy Awards.
She got back with the sister.
Obviously, she did. She obviously did. You saw that part, and then you saw that the person you saw. You could figure out from movie logic that the person who's also a performer in the nightclub thing hit her champion and fought his cousin Bruno, and she should have a good life in America. Spoiler alert, I guess. That'll be my guess. All right, everybody got the picture and thing? Okay. Just you should conceptualize this. All right, so the Jews are living near Hebron, all right, where we went on our Israel trip. Okay, right here. And they're now heading to where see where it says which is 1 and 2. Somewhere we don't know where the capital city was. Ramses could be there. 1. See where the 1 is? So there's a famine, and the Jewish people are leaving there. Okay, we'll get back. We'll be back. Okay, now let's run some chumash here. Who'd like to read first? Let me pick upon. I mean, call upon. Let me call upon. Our Shana. All right. So read. All right. Everybody got that psukim.
Jacob arrives in Egypt. Yaakov sent Yehuda ahead of him to make preparations in Goshen. They then arrived in the Goshen district. Yosef personally harnessed his chariot, and he went to greet his father Yisrael in Goshen. He presented himself to his father and threw himself on his shoulders, weeping on his shoulders for a long time. "Now I can die," said Yisrael to Yosef. "I have seen your face, and you are still alive." To his brothers and his father's family, Yosef said, "I will go and tell Paro. I will say the following to him. My brothers and my father's family have come to me from Canaan. These men deal in livestock and are tenders of sheep. They have brought along their sheep, their cattle, and all their possessions. When Paro summons you and inquires as to your occupation, you must say, 'We and our fathers have dealt in livestock all our lives.' You will then be able to settle in the Goshen district, since all shepherds are taboo in Egypt." Yosef went and told Paro. He said, "My father and brothers have come from Canaan along with their sheep, their cattle, and all their belongings. They are now in the Goshen district. From among his brothers, he selected 5 men and presented them to Paro. Paro asked Yosef's brothers, 'What is your occupation?' 'We are shepherds,' they replied to Paro, 'we and our fathers before us. We have come to stay a while in your land,' they explained to Paro, 'because there is no grazing for our flocks, so severe is the famine in Canaan. If you allow us, we will settle in the Goshen district.' Paro said to Yosef, 'Your father and brothers have now come to you. The land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and brothers in the best area. Let them settle in the Goshen district. If you have capable men among them, you can appoint them as livestock officers over my cattle.' Yosef brought his father Yaakov and presented him to Paro. Yaakov blessed Paro. 'How old are you?' asked Paro of Yaakov. 'My journey through life has lasted 130 years, replied Yaakov. The days of my life have been few and hard. I did not live as long as my fathers did during their pilgrimage through life.' With that, Yaakov blessed Paro and left his presence. Yosef found a place for his father and brothers to live. He gave them an estate in the Ramses region, in the best area, as Paro had ordered."
Okay. So is Bruno and Paro the same or different? Why not?
Yeah, because they look at people as what they can give. Yeah.
How do you know that was Paro's interest?
What it sounded like.
What about it sound like? You have to be correct, but I want to prove from the text.
You can look after my cattle, too.
Right. In other words, so first of all, they shows up. Since Yosef basically saved the entire Egypt, why is he now automatically making them into work for the state? Okay? But, and here's a question, which is question number 2 to make it very clear. Why did Yosef tell Yaakov and the brothers what to say? He told him exactly what to say. He says, "When Paro summons you and inquires you of your occupation, you must say, 'We and our fathers have dealt in livestock all of our lives. You'll be able to settle in the Goshen area, for all shepherds are taboo.'" What's Yosef's strategy here?
He wanted to keep them separate.
He wanted to keep them separate from what?
From the Egyptians, so they wouldn't fall into their way of life.
True. And what's the strategy to do that?
And that is to say that they were shepherds, because wasn't the animals like their gods or something?
Yes, that's what that says.
And that would be taboo for them to be shepherds in the midst of the Egyptians.
So let's work this out. Let's work on strategy. What fear? What does Yosef know that Paro will try to do? What is Paro, when Paro hears that the brother's coming back, what's his reaction? If you're Paro, and Yosef, who just saved the entire nation of Egypt, is coming with 11 brothers and a father, what are you thinking in your mind?
Like
them? No, not necessarily for that.
How can I prosper more from...
This is awesome! Yosef is a genius. He saved our entire empire. Not only that, he's able to leverage the famine into gathering all land and cash into the possession of the Paro. Imagine if I had 10 more Yosefs. It would be awesome. I'll take over the world. So what does Yosef do to block the shot? He basically says, we only know how to do one thing. The one thing which is essentially useless to the state, which is to be a shepherd. Because shepherding of animals was taboo in that culture, right? And it does makes them they can't be with everybody else because they're doing this loser activity. They got to be far away. But even so, what did Paro steal? He doesn't leave anything on the table. What did he grab? As Matt pointed out,
extra hands work.
Right. So all right, I can't put you into the government. Can't you be here at the Capitol? Can't you be doing work in our State Department or Defense Department or whatever department I have? But at least I got sheep also. You're now in charge of the sheep. Nobody beats Paro.
Yeah,
Nobody beats Bruno, and nobody beats these kind of personalities. People who are aggressive users of people will always have to use you. They have to take something. They're not satisfied with just leaving it. Oh, especially these guys are coming in. They're eating out of my land. Meanwhile, Yost had basically saved the entire people. But where's the gratitude? There's gratitude, but Yost anticipates it. He limits it. And as Jay pointed out, the fear, of course, is assimilation. Because what did Yosef concern that if they would join the government? Now, you think that Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zebulun, Dan, Manasseh, Gad, Asher, the other brothers at Binyamin are also talented dudes? Is it really, or at least some of them? Yeah. Now look at when they wielded old Yaakov, old Jake, into the palace thing. What was his move? So when Paro sees him, what's his reaction? Because he's obviously surprised, like, dang, you're old. Like, you know, like, how old are you? So what does he say? Two lives has lasted 130 years. And what is he quick to say? The days of my life have been few and hard. I did not live as long as my father. So he, what did he try to do? He's trying to remove what they call the Ayin Hara, the evil eye, the aspect of envy and person being jealous of it. He said, don't look at my life being great. I've had a terrible situation. All right? And then he gives them a bracha on the way out. Okay, very nice. Now, here's the key question. Why was the enslavement of the Jews almost inevitable? Well, his plan is to keep them safe from everybody else. And then they're going to be like their own little community. But what did Yosef not anticipate? And what's eventually going to happen?
The pharaoh would be a new pharaoh.
Okay, that's the one thing you didn't anticipate, correct?
But they were basically given a place in like the best part of the area.
So right.
They're given a position of almost nothing.
Of wealth, of position, of rank.
Because of wealth, so they are kind of involved now in
right.
Society,
but they're not really horrifying. Yeah. You know, even Yosef's strategy was to keep them somewhat isolated. But the strategy of isolation does not work. Eventually, you're going to evolve economically, socially. And what is people's natural, what is the desire of the minority always?
To be equal.
To be equal to whom?
I guess people that are then the locals.
Right, the majority population. People want to be loved and appreciated by the majority people. It's a natural tendency. What else happened?
I mean, they just grew in such big numbers that Pharaoh got worried that they were going to take over.
Right. So also what Yosef did not anticipate is that there's going to be a massive population explosion, right? And they're going to be, they've outgrown Goshen. Now they're living among the non-Jews. Okay. And now the non-Jews view them as what? As a threat. Exactly. All right. So... where the Jews become wealthy. So if you have Jews, this is really the history of the Jewish people. After we kicked out of the land after the first thing, where do we go? Babylonia. What happened to us? We became very comfortable there. We became financially successful there. What happened? We become, there's intermarriage, assimilation. And when the Persian king, after Babylonia's defeat and Persia takes over, and Cyrus gives him the permission to go build the repopulate the land of Israel and build the temple. How many Jews wanted to join them? 42,250. A fraction of the Jewish people. Because why? Because I'm on the Upper West Side. I'm in Miami Beach. I'm in LA. I'm having a good situation. We got kosher restaurants. We got, why do we want to go to Israel? Obviously, we're all here. We don't want to go to Israel all that much. We want to vacation in Israel. We don't want to live in Israel, as evidenced by us being here. So the bottom line is that as soon as we get comfortable, and then the second destruction. Then where do we get pushed into? All over the world, to Rome and to Europe, and the same thing happens until there's crushing anti-Semitism. But where we're comfortable, we get wealthy, and then we disappear. So that's another aspect of the three comments of the Pirkei Avot. Let's read it out. Tehillah. Yeah. Okay. And so read the comment there.
Rabbi Abdiah Bartimaeus comments, those positions of leadership, distance yourself and take leadership positions over the community for leadership
theory. Okay, so what's the thing? So if there's a position of power, what is the proper Jewish response?
Nothing else did.
Avoid it. Why? So there's a couple aspects. One is that power corrupts, and if you're going to be in a position of power, you're going to be corrupted. It's A. But what's the idea of the bear? So the bear, that's the two aspects of being buried, it buries his owner. What does it mean? How does leadership bury your owner, buries a person?
It takes you away from what's important in the world.
So that's really the corruption theory. That's one. What else? There's another aspect of leadership.
You keep doing, like, you do one thing to, like, keep you on the top, and then you do, like, another one and another one and another one.
So what does that do to you?
It makes you work, like, more people.
Well, so they're going back to the corruption theory. What else?
Unsatiable. One, you become unsatiable. You always want more. Okay. You can never be happy with what you have.
Okay.
And fear gives you a lot of responsibility to have a position of leadership.
And therefore,
you have no life.
Right, so basically the stress will kill you. In fact, they deduce that, this is from another statement in Pirkei Avos, is to avoid, it's Soneh et Rabbanut. Another comment is that how old was Yosef when he died? He was 110 years old, because his brothers were there, so he was the first of the brothers to die. So they learned from that he was running Egypt. He was number two guy. So the stress of having the stress of leadership is something which is physically debilitating.
That's so counterintuitive to our culture. And
yes, it is.
What we're taught.
It's literally the opposite.
We're taught to shoot. Or the stars, like,
yeah. So that sees that the goal of man is to be a god, to be a lord. Mm-hmm. We want to be a person. We want to be a person who is a person who has a balanced existence, who can support his family and be involved in his community. So, under what circumstances should you take a position of power?
If you absolutely have to.
What's the definition of absolutely have to?
God tells you to.
Okay. Assuming you're not a prophet, which is basically everybody. Under what circumstance should a person, another statement from Pirkei Avos, famous statement from Pirkei Avos. It's all, we're ending out with a Pirkei Avos piece on tonight. What?
Like charity or something?
Well, charity doesn't mean you have to be in a position of power. You have charity.
I think he was trying to say something about the Jewish people.
Do you have to be in a position of power to do something good for the Jewish people?
No, but in general, like generations.
So what situation should a person step up to the plate?
To protect Jews, maybe.
Okay, but that's okay, true. But what else? Is it only protecting Jews, but every time you should avoid it? The Pirkei Avos has a nice phrase. B'makom she'ein ish, hishtadel liyot ish. When there is no other person, you should step up to be that person. In other words, if you do not do it, it will not get done. So that shows that you're doing it because basically, if I don't do it, it ain't going to happen. And we, our community, our society of Jewish people will be reduced for that. Not that I'm looking for, I'm not looking for the honor to be to do it. But if I don't, the whole thing's gonna fall apart if I don't step up. If I don't take that position, it's gonna be bad. That's the only situation. So that makes it evident that you're not doing it for honor. You're doing it because you want everybody to say you're so great. That's the key principle. Right? That's the only time a person should take a position of responsibility in the community. That if you do not do it, it will not get done, or it will get done in a significantly inferior manner. Okay, and that's you have to check. You have to be honest here, because as Adrian pointed out, our society has been teaching us from day one: you should go for the spotlight. You should be the man. You should step out to the plate. That's it. You should be world famous. No, she would tell you avoid the spotlight at all costs, and if you have to. If nobody else will do it, then you step in for the amount of time, and then as soon as you can do it, you get out. Because nothing good happens when you're in the spotlight. And the truth is, if you don't believe me, go to 7-Eleven after class. It's always open. Okay? Not just 7 to 11. It used to be 7 to 11. And then you'll get a People magazine and read about Us magazine, or read all the experiences of all the people who are famous in our society, in our culture. Rock stars, movie stars, and what's happening to them? How's that working out for them? Not too well. A divorce, drug addiction, bankruptcy. It's like one tail a little after the other. It's like a terrible situation. If anybody was really realistic about what it is to be a famous person in America, like to run for president. You want to be president? No, because first of all, to go through if the party will accept you, Democrat, it's going to cost $2 billion. It's 2 years of basically constantly campaigning, and the press will look into every single thing that you ever did in your life and something that you didn't do, and will just and ruin your family. So the only person who can ever do this job is someone who's going to be so egomaniac that. Love of power so much they'll endure all the indignities that this exists. It's literally the opposite of what we've had in America. Okay? Avoid positions of power. Because either the stress will get to you or the power of corruption will get to you. It's not going to end well. You only do it if you don't step up to the plate, you won't get done. That's the only legitimate reason. Everything else is just indulging our narcissism and our love of glory. And it didn't land well for Yosef. He landed in time. Now, last statement, which is also from Pirkei Avos, will be the last line before we call it another Lila. All right, Jonathan.
Okay. Then the deputy high priest said, pray for the welfare of the government, but without fear of it, follow his fellow alive.
Yes. So every Shabbat, MJE, and nearly every synagogue, literally in the world, there'll be a prayer for the government. So if you're in Canada, it'll be a prayer for Canada. And if you're in England, it'll be England. And of course, we'll also pray for Israel as well. Why? Why do we pray for the government?
That they'll do the right thing for the people.
Doesn't mean it's a good government, even if it's not a great government. Why do we pray for the government? Why is the government a good? Why? Because no matter how bad, exactly. Because no matter how bad a government is, it's still substantially law and order, even if it's done in a slightly unjust way or a very unjust way, it's still way better than. Every man for himself, and there's no rule of law, and basically people don't get destroyed. So the bottom line is that our attitude toward the government is twofold. On the one hand, it's a vital institution; you need to have a government, and there need to be people working the government, and there need to be people who are running the government. Having said that, the positions of power, you as a person who wants to avoid the downfalls, you want to not have to, you don't want to be like, what was Paul trying to do to Yosef's brothers? Yeah, co-opt them into his government to make his, because either, because Paro and the Brunos of the world will just try to use you. So if you're working in the government, you're not working with the government is working you. It's trying to use you to their oftentimes unjust ends. Okay?
They start off as looking over the capital, and then next thing you know, they're going into other things.
Yes, it didn't exactly. It ended badly. Now, if you fast forward, like the prophet Daniel, when Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylon king, comes in, and what does he do to the great young people of the land of Israel? What does he do to them? Very smart move. It's the book of Daniel. He does, he takes all the best, brightest people and puts them into essentially his State Department. And he presses them into not just, you know, physical service, but intellectual governmental service. And the one who rises to the top is Daniel. And he's a prophet. So that's the whole story. He's basically working for, and of course the other people are jealous of him. It's another part of the thing. When you're successful, people want to what? Destroy you. And the other people, and that's the famous, he's throwing into the den of lions. They have to work out a whole ruse to show that he's really disloyal to the king. And then the miracle happens that the lions, the hungry lions don't eat him. Okay? It's the same, you know, read the book of Daniel. Or read the Wikipedia version of it if you're really low on time. Whatever. So there's a double-edged thing. So going back to our little infographic, the first step is that basically the Brunos and the Paros will take advantage of the fact that you have no connection, you have no power, and they'll try to basically use you to their end, whether it's prostitution in the case of the movie of Bruno, or Paro to become slaves to his. In other words, slavery could have started at the very beginning. Paro could have basically said, you become, you know, a paid slave, but working for his state. Yosef sort of deflected them, got them into the land of Goshen, where they had some reprieve, but the desire to be loved, to be part of the mockers, to be part of the players, to get accepted into the country club, that desire, and with wealth, has an insidious force of getting you sucked into the culture. And so therefore, if the Egyptians were evil, bad people or corrupt people, the Jews became corrupt people. And that is step one of our 10 steps to redemption. Well, the Jews basically, and also the key element here is that Yaakov and the brothers who were part of the leadership, they die, and the kids who took over for them were not as powerful visionaries of Judaism. So you have a terrible conflict. You have the Jews are becoming spread out, involved in Egypt, and the leadership, the educational leadership, the thought leaders of Jewish people are not present, or not present to the same degree. So you have a bad form of people being educated by Egypt, and the counter, the Jewish educators are not up to the task, and therefore the Jews get pulled under, which is basically the tale of America as well. In other words, the story of the similar story, it's always the same story. So that's why the story of Egypt is sort of not just the story of Egypt, it's the universal of the Jewish people. So we're learning the story in two lenses. One is the story that happens there, universalizing the principles and seeing it as sort of like the history repeating itself. Babylonia, Persia, the Hellenists, the Greeks, right? The story of Hanukkah, the Romans, the Roman Empire. Okay, and of course the Christian nations, the Islamic nations, being forced brutally to work for them and be victimized by them. And the natural, and when things get a little better, we want to be loved by them, so we can become like them, and therefore lose our Jewish identity. And that's basically the story. So that's where we're starting at the rock bottom, and we will pick up next week, and we will go on to another.